is May 9th, 2015. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm broadcasting from the sunny Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. And, of course, my website is spingola.com. And you can visit my website for links for today's program. Just click on the radio schedule button on the left. I also invite you to visit screeningsandyhook.com for information about my new book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, which is now available as a paperback, a hardback, and as a Kindle from Amazon. And of course, you can also get the two versions from me. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, a site that one of our listeners created and maintains. It's a great site. He has a lot of very interesting things there. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by visiting spingola.chatango.com. We will also be taking questions via my email at comment@spingola.com. Alrighty, our guest today. Oh, and of course, in the third hour, if we decide to take callers, we will do that in the third hour. And the phone number is 800-313-9443. Keep your questions relevant and on the topic of the day. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the American Nationalist Association and American Nationalist Network. And that website is ANA-ANN.com. Rodney, are you there?
I'm here, Deanna.
Okay, great. Super, super.
Do we have a better connection now?
Yes. I don't hear any interference at all.
Yeah, well, I had my son come over and do some switcheroos, so we should be okay now.
Oh, this technology is something else. I have learned a lot of interesting things about technology lately, and you can make the least little change, or Skype can make the least little change, and it will just throw you off. And but there's just little tricks and things that you need to know to make everything work. And most of the time it does, but sometimes it doesn't. It's really a pain.
Well, if it's not the basics, I motioned him to come over, and he just switched it out there. I got two systems, and so he switched it out, and so this works. My good mic, I had to send in for repairs, so I'm actually having to use the backup, but I'm glad we got it fixed.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to thank you for having me back. You know, I think, at one point I was 900, and then I've been on a couple of times, so, you know,
yes.
I'm keeping count. I'm hoping to make the 1,000 mark at some point.
Okay, I'm going to write you in right now for 1,000.
Yeah, I'm hoping to make that mark. But, you know, this week has been an interesting week. Well, the last 2 weeks, and we've had everybody celebrating the 70 years. And, you know, having me on, I thought we could comment on that, and then we can talk about Charles's, you know, Hitler series and the incredible amount of misinformation that he talked about in that series. And, you know, he inevitably will latch on to a topic and go on and go on and go on. And as you know, he's on my network, and I generally do not go on, and I don't bash my hosts on my network, and I'm not going to do so today after I talk about the 70th anniversary, but I am going to address in detail his thesis, which I think is completely wrong and void of any degree of intellectual honesty at all. But if I can first talk about the 70th anniversary that Western Europe and Eastern Europe are celebrating basically independently this year because of the issues in Ukraine, you have the old Soviets, Russians are rolling out the largest military parade that they've had in, you know, probably 25 to 30 years. And I think that's more bluster than it is to celebrate the end of the war. And then in Western Europe, they've had a recent article I saw, which I thought was interesting. It had, it was in London, and it talked about Western Europe celebrates, the defeat of the Nazis. And I was thinking about that, you know, in reflection, you know, what did they win? The only people that won anything was international Jewry, and it was the end of really Western Christian civilization. Because at the end of the war, the British Empire ceased to exist. Britain was bankrupt. A few years earlier, they had hawked themselves, given away a lot of their possessions to the Americans in exchange for antiquated equipment. You had, you know, Roosevelt started that entire war, and I'm going to talk about that as after we talk about the 70th anniversary, because I think Charles Giuliani fell into the rat trap of Hitler starting the war in 1939, when in fact it was Roosevelt and Bullitt telling the Poles to not negotiate with the Germans over Danzig. And I'm going to dwell into my favorite source material, original sources, and I firmly believe that in 1939 the Poles and the Germans could have resolved Danzig amongst themselves had it not been for Roosevelt. And history really does not talk about Roosevelt's intrigue and in getting the Poles to basically develop a very vitriolic anti-German attitude, which had not been present some, you know, maybe 12 months previous, in order to, you know, start a war that Roosevelt desperately wanted, and I dare say a war that really Britain and France didn't want, and one that France really didn't want. You know, France really did not didn't really care about going into war over a German city, but they did because of the guarantees that they had made with Britain. And Chamberlain, you know, not too long before he died, mentioned that that he had been hoodwinked into issuing a guarantee that they could not you know, couldn't do anything about, couldn't back up. And interestingly, if they were going to guarantee Poland's borders, they were only interested in guaranteeing Poland's western borders against the Germans, because the Soviets invaded from the east and there was no guarantee of Poland's eastern borders. And Joseph Stalin ended up with more Polish territory than the Germans. And Britain and France said nothing.
Right.
Absolutely nothing. And history does not talk about if Britain and France was going to guarantee Polish territorial integrity, then why did they not declare war on the Soviet Union? And they didn't even request the Red Army withdraw their troops from Polish territory.
Right.
There was never a declaration.
17 days after Germany went in. And Germany actually had a reason to go in.
That's right. But Britain and France never made an official declaration that the Red Army withdraw from Polish territory. And there's every reason to believe that, of course, it was when the Red Army goes in, the then NKVD, which is the precursor to the KGB, immediately liquidates the intelligentsia. You know, there's no reason to believe British intelligence, which, you know, was engaged, has always engaged in a great deal of chicanery around the world. They knew what Stalin was. Churchill knew what Stalin was. The British knew what Stalin was. In 1938, Stalin offered to the British and the French to invade Germany through Poland over Czechoslovakia, and they declined because, that quite frankly, they were more afraid of Stalin than they were of the Germans. And they actually liked, they thought that Germany would be a bulwark against international communism, which is kind of interesting to say the least. And what they didn't count on was Roosevelt, who was a pawn of international Jewry and a communist himself, intriguing, you know, on behalf of basically international communism, and intriguing and getting in the middle of Polish politics and starting a war in Europe. It's truly amazing the degree of political, geopolitical chicanery. that started this war in 1939 and evolved it into what it was, which brought the forces of Jewish communism and Jewish capitalism to bear on this small nation state that had adopted a third way economic program called National Socialism, and all it sought was to regain its territorial and economic integrity and to be left alone and to create a Jew-free economy and a Jew-free society. And this is what this was all about. And they've had celebrations celebrating their, you know, celebrating the 70th anniversary of the defeat of Germany. And, you know, I recently heard a statement out of the British elections that I think is relevant to the defeat of Germany. And I'm going to paraphrase it. The hyenas can dance on the body of the lion, but the hyenas can never be a lion. And I think that is the lesson of the defeat of Germany in 1945, because at the end of 1945, France was no longer an international player on the world scene. They had lost their empire, you know, for all intents and purposes. When France surrendered on June the 22nd, 1941 to Germany, they were done. France ceased to exist as a major international player. Today, I mean, they, you know, they, De Gaulle ran like a coward to Britain and organized this, you know, ineffective Free French force. He was basically just a token courtesy. He never should have been given an occupation zone in Germany, never should have been recognized as a government. It was a violation of international law. But even after the war, France has existed as a token courtesy, as another United States puppet. The same mm-hmm. goes for Britain. Britain mm-hmm. was bankrupt. Had lost a great deal of its international holdings, was forced to quit India because it was bankrupt, was forced, you know, to leave. You know, the old saying used to be the sun never sets on the British Empire, but because it chose to be on the wrong side of history and fight for the international Jewish system against the Germans, the sun set on the British Empire in May of 1945, and it has ceased to exist. I mean, the British fleet used to be the most prestigious navy in the world. Today, it only has three functional aircraft carriers. I dare say that its last great victory was over Argentina, which it barely won back in the 80s. I dare say if Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands today, Britain couldn't do anything about it. They are so weak and anemic. And that is a legacy of Britain fighting not once, but twice on the wrong side of history. The first time in 1914, the second time in 1939 on the forces of international Jewry. So this is what they're celebrating. They are actually celebrating. I mean, this is akin to a person getting drunk and doing something incredibly stupid and then celebrating, you know, being proud about it. I mean, this is what, this is what they're celebrating.
Amazing.
The, you know, the Russians, on the other hand, they're still embracing Stalin, the man that, you know, butchered probably 100 million of their own people, that raped, robbed, and pillaged,
and glorifying
not only
the Red Army. I just can't buy that.
Why
would you glorify the Red Army?
Yeah, I mean, not only that is, you know,
in Israel yet.
Yeah, in the eastern sectors of Berlin, there are still Soviet war memorials that the municipal government of Berlin pays out of German taxpayers to maintain. And last year, the United States' biggest ally, Israel, had Vladimir Putin in Israel to unveil a memorial to the Red Army liberators of Eastern Europe.
Yep.
And so, and this is what the United, I mean, this is just absolutely incredible. That not only some, now Eastern Europe, I must say, the Hungarians to some degree, especially the Baltic states, Latvia and Estonia have taken down those Soviet war memorials, in some cases thrown them in landfills or just humiliated them. They have shown courage of conviction. But Western Europe, I mean, have kowtowed to peoples in Western Europe, still have this Stockholm syndrome, as do, you know, the Russians, to embrace their rapist. I mean, this is incredible. You have family members. I recently saw an interview on RT where the brother of a person who was arrested, tortured, and executed in the Gulag was praising Stalin. I mean, this is incredible. And of course, it wouldn't surprise me if he was chugging vodka before and after the interview. It's just absolutely incredible the fantasy land some of these people are on. Now, you contrast that with the Ukrainians and the Lithuanians when the German army swept into Western Russia, Belarus, and Lithuania. The German Wehrmacht was greeted as liberators. There's film, there's pictures where, of course, accompanying every Wehrmacht unit were chaplains, both Protestant and Catholic. And of course, Stalin had shut down and persecuted the Catholic Church and the Orthodox. The Catholic Church, it was very predominant in Lithuania, for instance. And there's film where Stalin had seized the Baltic states in 1940, so they had been over a year had been, you know, denied communion and denied the Eucharist. And here you have German Catholic chaplains providing mass for these peasants in Lithuania the first time in over a year. And in the Ukraine, you have Catholic chaplains, the Wehrmacht providing the Eucharist and mass services for Ukrainian peasants. There's pictures of that as well, for the first time in almost 20 years. And so, you know, this wasn't, you know, what people are indoctrinated by Hollywood and the Hitler Channel, and most certainly what they're not indoctrinated in Putin's Russia. And I dare say there are a lot of what I consider Putin groupies in the ethno-nationalist movement that think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and he's absolutely not. He goes out of his way to persecute and imprison people who write the correct history of the war, and it's a sad day when you have people who this week are writing about how sad it was, you know, that the Germans lost the war, and yet the week prior and next week will be singing the praises of Vladimir Putin when he is standing up on Lenin's tomb, praising the rapists and the butchers of East Prussians, Silesians, Pomeranians, and other Germans that the Red Army promulgated the greatest mass rape and destruction, cultural genocide, and ethnic cleansing in history. In 1946-47, the puppet president of East Germany, Wilhelm Pieck, and Konrad Adenauer made a joint statement that 6 million, note the number 6 million, they used the number 6 million Germans were dead. And those were the 6 million Germans that had been forcibly removed from the eastern territories that had previously been Germany proper. And they said they had not arrived in the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, or the Federal Republic, West German sectors. So they had to have been dead, eradicated. Exactly. And it was shortly thereafter that Pieck was replaced, as the head of East Germany.
Okay, Rodney, we're going to a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back, and our guest today is Rodney Martin, and that website is ANA-ANN.com, and that stands for American Nationalist Association and American Nationalist Network.
Deanna, let me make a slight correction. As of March 1st, we became the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network because we're international now. We have affiliates and hosts in Europe now, and we decided to basically embrace the pan-Aryan type of philosophy that was being developed in Germany, you know, between the Germans and the other European nation states. You know, from about 1941 on. And so we changed. Yeah.
Okay, so it's what?
All nationalist association and all nationalist network.
Okay.
And our board of directors now consists of both persons from the United States and the European continent.
Okay. I just copy-pasted what you used to be from one of your previous programs. So, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. At least you didn't have to change anything. I mean,
no, that was one of the reasons we thought about that, because we didn't want to have to start another website, and so we kept the, you know, the URL. We didn't have to alter that. We did have to change our graphics, and we had to start changing some of our, it caused a lot of production work, which we're still doing, but we went on. Now, I also wanted to remind the guests that the WV Foundation site is up, and I'm going to be citing material from that, because I do have several original source documents up from the, sorry, the Reichslaw Gazette, and that is one of my pet peeves. When people go on and start doing this nonsense about Hitler was a Jewish agent, and they don't cite sources, or they cite some, you know, WordPress blog that's basically more opinion and conspiracy theory, because, you know, the German, you know, the National Socialist government left us a plethora of original documents and materials. And you can go through them, and the body of work speaks to itself. And I'm going to use primarily original source documents when I get into refuting Charles's series on Hitler. I'm not going to get into the Henry Ford stuff. I will talk about that very briefly, but I just wanted to kind of finish up on this, you know, this anniversary, because it is such an incredible event in history, a turning point in history, because at the end of the war, Britain was gone. By 1948, it was bankrupt. It was funny because Clement Attlee set his ministers over. You know, Churchill, in the only election that he ran in, you know, he was appointed prime minister when Chamberlain quit. He wasn't elected or anything.
Right.
And he runs and he loses to the liberal Clement Attlee. And Attlee inherits a bankrupt, broken England, and so he has to have a fire sale and get rid of the British Empire, so it's gone in a matter of 24 months. And what's interesting is Hermann Göring, from his cell in Nuremberg, wrote a letter predicting this, as did Goebbels. Goebbels was the first man to talk about the Iron Curtain descending across Europe. And what did Churchill do? Plagiarized him. A few years later, in a speech at a college in Missouri when he was out of office. It's incredible that the Germans, the National Socialist government, predicted everything that would happen if they were defeated. The German objective was first, when they came to power in 1933, was to remove the Judeo influence in their government, in their culture, into free Germany. When this war was forced upon them, this broader war, they had no plans for a broader European war. They weren't going to run out and conquer the world like everybody talks about. Hitler envisioned just retaking the Danzig and the Polish corridor and returning to Germany what was rightfully Germany, Danzig and West Prussia, that which was right, that was stolen from them in the Treaty of Versailles, these areas that were German population. When this war was forced upon them, they used the opportunity to basically kick the Jewish influence, the Jewish banking cabal, and this foreign system and foreign influence out of Europe and return Europe to the Europeans. If you ask the French, go and ask elderly Frenchmen, those that are still alive, you know, how they fared under German occupation, they don't have a lot of complaints. As a matter of fact, they talk about the German blitzkrieg through France in May and June of 1940. The country was conquered rather quickly. There was very low casualty rates, and the German occupation forces had a strict code of discipline and honor not to rape, rob, and pillage. They went into French shops, as they did on the British islands in the Channel. They were told to pay for what they bought. They treated the civilian population properly. Now, those members of the resistance and engaged in, you know, terrorism and partisan activity, they were dealt with harshly, in accordance with the rules of war. And but the French civilians had no real complaints. We're going to break. I'll pick this up on the backside.
All righty, be back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association. and the All Nationalist Network, and that website is ANA-ANN.com, and his other website is WVFoundations.org. Okay. Continue from where you left off, and regarding John's message, it's true. You are not going to hear the stuff that we talk about on other radio programs. You're not going to hear about the film that he mentioned, Hellstorm. When I watched that, I started bawling. Almost immediately. I mean, it just, if you think the book is impactful, emotionally impactful, the film is even more so. Just think about it. Just as emotional. Okay, Rodney. Are you there? Where's Rodney?
I'm here, Deanna. Sorry, I had my mic muted, and I forgot to unmute it. You know, as you know, Deanna, I've interviewed Germans that actually lived through, you know, the hell of 1944 through 46. One of them was actually in the Sudetenland and witnessed the Czech massacre, you know, the Czech communists. And let me qualify that. The Czech communist massacre and ethnic cleansing of the Sudetenland. Because the history records that the Czechs and the Germans got along just fine, and a lot of Czechs were anti-communist and worked quite well with the Germans. It was the Czech communist under Beneš that unleashed hell on the Germans. And to this day, the Beneš decrees remain in effect as the law of the land in the Czech Republic. And shame on the European Union for allowing the Czech Republic to function with, you know, while having those decrees still on the books. It's a testament to the hypocrisy of the European Union that they would allow a country within the European Union to function while having those types of decrees that institutionalize genocide and ethnic cleansing as the law. And yet they go after Hungary, who adopted a new constitution that kicked out the Jewish bankers and such, and they basically condemn Hungary. They are destroying the Greek nation state. But they're okay with the Czech Republic, with the Beneš decree still on the books. But what I was saying before the break, and I also want to concur with what John had said during the break, there's very few networks that will allow people like me to come on. I mean, I haven't gotten a call from Fox News or MSNBC yet. Now, to their credit, I appear regularly on Press TV, and I've recently appeared on three other networks in the Middle East, attacking the Jewish political and economic system. But none of the mainstream media in the United States are going to give me a platform, and there's very few that operate here. Republic is one that you're going to be able to hear my views and your views. My network, obviously, is one you're going to be able to hear those views. And of course, we give a platform to a lot of our comrades in Europe that are denied that ability because of the laws where they live. But I would encourage people to support RBN, and I want to thank RBN for allowing me to come on and share, you know, this historical perspective. I am an original source historian. I'm also a nationalist, and I have to be very careful not to allow my political views to, you know, dissuade or color my historical work, because sometimes there's a conflict. And I think this is what's happened with Charles. I think his personal views, his personal animosity, say towards the church, sometimes, you know, interferes with his ability to really, disseminate, you know, research and information. And we see that in some of his emotionally charged oversimplifications. And I think we've seen this on his Hitler series as well. We've seen, he talks about Hitler wanting an all-powerful state, and he talks about the war and things of that nature. And I'll get into that. And I think we have to be very careful. I think we can be strong in our political views, but if we're going to get into historical research, we have to be able to differentiate the two and go where the facts go. And I try to do that, and that's why I rely primarily on original sources and let the documents and the evidence, you know, dictate the narrative. And quite frankly, the original source material, Deanna, I think strengthens our case and destroys the narrative, you know, the Jewish narrative, the Marxist narrative, the, you know, the champions of political correctness. I think it destroys their narrative, because if you just follow the rules of evidence in any sort of court proceedings, if you use the original source materials, which they all like to do, if you use them all of them in totality, in context, we destroy their case. Keep in mind, the Nuremberg tribunals cherry-picked evidence, it created evidence, it used torture, it beat people, and it also dictated to the defendants what defense they could raise and what they couldn't. It dictated what evidence they could present and what they could not. It also forbid them from bringing the defense and reminding the judges, and, you know, they were kangaroo judges, reminded them that the Allies had engaged in far worse conduct than what the Germans had engaged in. It basically was a Soviet kangaroo court. And right. Out of the three, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, Churchill wanted to engage in summary executions. It was Stalin and Roosevelt that came up with the idea of the show trials, because Stalin was a perfectionist at it. An absolute perfectionist. And we've seen that, and quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, the United States judicial system has basically cloned this concept of the show trial. People may think they're getting a fair shake. They may think that they are, you know, they can go to court and win and prevail, but the United States justice system, controlled by this Jewish plutocracy, is basically a show trial system. That's all it is. But getting back, as I want to finish up on this anniversary of the 70th anniversary. What I was mentioning, if you talk to the French, they, and you get them and talk to them candidly and honestly, they will tell you that the Allied liberation in 1944 was a terror. The Allies bombed everything, and when they finally came ashore and swept, you know, from Normandy across France, they raped, robbed, pillaged, and destroyed everything. If you look at France, in 1940, after the German Blitzkrieg, it was intact. There was very little damage. The French system, the French society was functioning. If you look at France in 1944, the Allies destroyed France. They bombed everything. Women were raped. It was just incredible what the Allies did in the name of liberating France from the evil Nazis. It's just incredible. And the French have recently, in the last, I say, 2 years, French, elderly French people have begun to speak out, saying that it really, what were they being liberated from? Because the Allied treatment was horrible, that the Germans acted honorably.
Right. And which I cover in my third book, which I actually sent Charlie a copy of, a PDF copy of my third book when it came out, and I covered most of the things that he has covered in his series this past week, but I use original source material, which is not doctored. It's the doctored stuff that they use for the commissions and the tribunals and all the other stuff. Those are based on preconceived conclusions, and well, on a stacked court or a stacked commission that all agrees to reach a consensus, and that consensus is usually, of course, lies that they want to spoon feed the public.
Well, I think you just hit the main point, is that the mass public enjoys being spoon-fed, because, you know, let's face it, people are lazy. And if they can have, you know, this is why people are obese. They enjoy fast food. They enjoy convenience. They enjoy having everything done for them. This is why they rely on their smartphones and mass media. I mean, people don't need, this is why they enjoy those online dating services. I mean, it's incredible how our society has devolved into decadence out of convenience. we've devolved into decadence in the name of convenience because everybody is lazy. It's amazing how people just absolutely believe. I mean, you ask them where they get their information and what they base their opinions and knowledge of history on. It's almost always Hollywood. We had this, you know, this absolute degenerate Brad Pitt made another World War II movie, and he's basically, he's an Allied American tank commander with 10 soldiers and a couple of tanks, and he takes on 200 Waffen SS troops and, you know, 20 tanks, and he beats them all. I mean, really? Really? I mean, Michael Vittman, we just Google somebody in the chat room or listening, Google Michael Vittman. I mean, let's get real. Does anybody really believe that, you know, that could have happened? First of all, the German tanks were far superior to the American tanks, but this is what we are indoctrinating. This is what the Hollywood Jews are indoctrinating our people and our young people to believe. And the whole concept of what our people have been indoctrinated to believe that Germany was like between the period 1933 and 1945, and I've always taken the position that you have to look at Germany in two periods. Well, actually, basically three, 1933 to August of 34, and then from 34 to 39, and then, or to 41, and then from 41 to 45, because the war really took on a different dynamic from in 1941 to the end in 45. But that period of 33, 34 to 1939 really has to be studied separately in what the National Socialists did in peacetime, in terms of social policy, in terms basically of economic policy. And it's their economic policy is why the Jewish banking system, you know, using the economic powers in Washington and London, came after them. Make no mistake about it, World War II and the combined efforts of international Jewish capitalism and international Jewish communism came after the National Socialist system because of their economic system. And today, you can't go to any university, you can't go to any school, you can't go anywhere and discuss economics in which National Socialist Third Way economics is discussed on par as a viable economic theory, on par with, say, socialism, communism, and capitalism, free market, and libertarianism. They won't allow it. And you have to ask why. And I think that is one of the biggest, counter arguments to Charles's Hitler series. There was a reason why they had to smash National Socialist Germany, and Churchill said it in a speech that one of the main reasons for the war against Germany was Germany engaged in economic self-sufficiency. Number one, they controlled their markets. They could, you know, Germany for the Germans. I can't make it any more clear. And yet this week, everybody is celebrating this 70th anniversary. And if you ask a common person on the street, especially the young person, all they have in their mind is the evil Nazi. I mean, we still see these, you know, nonsensical movies, either the big, you know, the big Hollywood movies, or even then, you know, the silly B movies that you rent in these movie kiosks. It's always the evil Nazi zombies. It's the evil Nazis up on the moon. You never hear about the evil communist zombies. You never hear about the evil communists. And yet, you know, Stalin had, you know, 50 million people in the gulags. He starved to death about 11 million Ukrainians in between 1936 to 1938. You'd never hear. Where 30, is the
32 and 33 too?
Yeah, where do you hear about the Holodomor? Where do you hear about that Holocaust? You don't. And right. It's truly incredible. And as we get into this response to the Charlie's Hitler series, I think we're going to find that there is far, far more evidence to support that National Socialist Germany was the last bulwark against international Jewry, the international banking cartel, and it was truly the last time that the Jews were kicked out of a government, of a political system, out of a culture, and they were on their way of getting kicked out of Europe. And that is why very early in 1933, after Hitler was appointed chancellor under the Constitution, and I want to talk about that as well, he didn't seize power. He didn't appoint himself dictator. That is why they started their boycotts. They went right to work. They went to work before there were actually any German legislation promulgated in response. As a matter of fact, Germany didn't even respond to the worldwide Jewish boycott until 2 years after the fact. So I think that's important to note as well. What was the final decision on taking callers?
If we take callers, we will take them in the third hour. If we decide to take callers, many of the residents in the area of starvation in the Ukraine in 1932-33 were what is called Volga Germans. Those were the Germans that settled in the late 1700s. And just absolutely made the Ukraine the breadbasket of Europe. And because they knew how to work the soil, they knew what to do. And so Russian Queen Catherine invited them in, and they made that area the breadbasket of Europe. So those were Germans.
Well, absolutely, and I think there was a reason. I think there was a reason when the German Wehrmacht swept into the Soviet Union in June of 1941 that they were welcomed as liberators by the ethnic Ukrainians. And there was, I think, there was a reason why it was the people, say the Lithuanians, the ethnic Lithuanians, the ethnic Estonians, and the ethnic Ukrainians that took vengeance on the Jewish commissars. And as a matter of fact, as the Red Army retreated and these commissars were left behind the lines, most of these retributions were taking place, you know, as the Germans entered the cities. They were already, I mean, literally the Ukrainians and the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Estonians were already literally stringing these Jewish commissars up and dancing on their bodies before the Germans even got there. But yet in the post-war, in the aftermath in 45, the Germans were blamed for this. And quite frankly, I don't blame those the Ukrainians and the Lithuanians, Latvians for taking vengeance on these Jewish commissars for having raped their little girls killing their husbands and fathers.
Quick break. Welcome back. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. The website is ana-ann.com. His other website is wvfoundations.org. There was something, too, that in addition to the other, to the economic situation, the economic issues for the bankers going after them is, and I was just doing a bunch of reading this morning, the fact that that the Germans had come up with several different plans on evacuating, relocating the Jews, and were pretty effective in having support from other European nations in their efforts. And they had to change their plans because war was instituted against them. But when you put the two together, you're saying, okay, we've got this new economic policy, and by the way, we're getting rid of the people, or we're going to evacuate the people who created this problem for our country. We are evacuating them out of our country. And I think if the other European nations did the same thing, change their banking system, get rid of the bankers, and then evacuate the people who are creating the problem, you're going to have, a very unhappy ethnic group that we all know who it is. Okay, what do you think?
Well, nobody wanted them, including the United States. And I'm going to get into this policy of immigration, because what I love it when we're able to accomplish two goals at the same time, Deanna. And during the course of this show, we're going to do a lot of holohoax debunking as well. We're going to respond to Charles because one of his proposals or thesis is that Hitler really didn't go after the Jews, or he didn't go after all of them. He was a Jewish, you know, he was one of the Jews guys. And, you know, we're going to show the fact that, you know, from the time the National Socialists took power, they began a process step by step of creating a Jew-free political structure, a Jew-free economy, and that actually they did. And we're going to look at the numbers, we're going to look at the result, we're going to look at original sources. But to answer your question, nobody wanted those Jews, and actually, we, you know, not even the United States. And that was even discussed at the Wannsee Conference in January of 1942. Right. And I actually have a copy of the transcript of the Wannsee Protocol, and that is not, by the way, the Wannsee Protocol. It took place. It was a meeting because some of the people that were there survived the war and lived until, some of them lived until 1980. And it was basically a discussion about what they were going to do with the remaining Jews within the German sphere of influence, because they couldn't do immigration during the war because they were at war. But they talked about the immigration numbers and the fact that there was a member of the State Secretary's Office of the Reichschancellery is there, and said that the Führer, Hitler, had said quite openly that the Jewish question would be deferred until after the war. Well, exactly. That statement is pretty clear, that there is not going to be a systematic government policy of eradicating a whole group of persons.
Right. All righty. We're at the top of the hour. We will be back in 3 minutes.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. That website is ANA-ANN.com. The other website is WVFoundations.org. And you were talking about the 1C conference protocols transcript, and of course that it was totally it was deportation. It was evacuation. It was never extermination. And but then during the war, the war economy needed workers that they simply didn't have. They were fighting a war on two fronts. So go ahead and pick it up where you left off.
Well, that was exactly right. I'll get into that, but let me lay the foundation. Let me just start getting into some of the concepts. That first of all, I think Charles's last show was did Hitler die in the bunker? We've covered that, Deanna, and what I want to do is direct our listeners to the last show that you and I did, and we talked about that extensively. Charles's show and content, his show and content, in which he discussed his premise that Hitler was whisk away, and he talked about some of the Hitler's people in the inner circle, and he didn't even get their names and their statements correct, was so poorly researched and so poorly cited that I am not going to respond to it. I'm going to just simply direct our listeners to the last show that I did with you prior to this one on the topic of Hitler's death in the bunker, because contrary to I think Charles's main point is that people in Hitler's inner circle's story changed or was not consistent, and that is absolutely false. I actually read their statements both during Soviet captivity between 1945 and 1948 when they were interrogated, and then I actually read their published works in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they were remarkably consistent in that what they related. They were all of their narratives were completely consistent in that at least two or three of them saw Hitler's body with his wife on the couch, her slumped over on his side. They actually saw the bullet wound. They all saw that they wrapped the body in the blanket. We actually, you know, we described the narrative where actually one of his aides took Ava's body from Bormann because they knew that she did not Bormann. I mean, their stories are completely and absolutely consistent until the end of their lives. There's just no doubt about that. Now, I even talked about the skull fragment in the Soviet archives being a female and who I believe that is. That is theory until there's some DNA evidence and whether the Russian archivists will ever allow that. That's up to them. But they have Hitler's jaw. And his and that jaw shows all of the bridge work and artificial teeth work that Hitler was known for. Also, Charles's point was that there was some American intelligence officer had written a report and said that no American court, probate court, or insurance company would pay a claim based on that. Well, the fact of the matter was Hitler's sister went through a court proceeding and presented all of the affidavits and statements, and he was declared legally dead, and his will was probated. So I think Charles missed something. The fact of the matter is a court did actually review all of the statements and declared him legally dead in the bunker on April 30th, 1945. His will was probated, and that is why the Bavarian Finance Ministry ended up with the rights to Mein Kampf, because Hitler's will indicated that that's where they would go in the absence of the party, and the party was outlawed. I don't think Hitler realized what the Allied Control Council would do to Germany and outlaw the party after his death. But I think Charles missed that detail because he didn't engage in a lot of research. I think he just went to a couple of websites and maybe he visited. I'm smelling a lot of Jim Condon in Charles's shows, and that's very, very unfortunate. So that's all I'm going to say on his show on Did Hitler Die in the Bunker. I'm going to just leave it there and encourage your listeners to go back and listen to our show on that. Now I want to get into the rest of his points, and I want to lay the foundation on a couple of things. Charles is, and I think it's important to kind of read into Charles's philosophy and worldview. He talked about Hitler wanting an all-powerful state, and he wanted to be the ruler and such. Well, there's some truth to that. The fact of the matter is the National Socialist state operated on the leadership principle. However, Charles and all the other Charles supporters, that concept, and Charles goes back to the Enabling Act, I believe is where his criticism is, that was codified and voted on and approved on not only by the German Reichstag in accordance with the Weimar Constitution, which was never, ever repealed by the National Socialist government. The Weimar Constitution was nullified by the Allied Control Council in 1945. It was never. The Weimar Constitution operated, and the National Socialists operated within accordance with the Weimar Constitution until their government was dissolved by the Allied Control Council. When I say dissolved, that's the Dönitz government dissolved by Eisenhower in Flensburg in 1945. But where I think Charles's beef is the Enabling Act, which was passed by the Reichstag on March 24th, 1933, in the wake of the Reichstag fire, which Charles also brought up. So I think it's important, before we get into some of the other important information, is let's look at this Enabling Act. Germany was in chaos economically, politically, socially, culturally, on all fronts. It was heavily in debt to American Jewish bankers. Then you have this group of communists that went and burned the Reichstag down after Hitler was appointed chancellor. It's important to note that there is video footage of the night of the Reichstag fire. I think it's available on YouTube, but it's also available in other sources. I would encourage listeners to go and look at that video. Hitler showed up after the, as the firefighters were putting that out. Also, President von Hindenburg showed up. Now, you can read a lot into people's facial expressions and their body language. Both Hitler and President von Hindenburg were physically upset and disheveled at that fire. I mean, they were, you could tell this wasn't something that you could tell that was just a put up. It was clearly done by the communists. And this is, let's just face it, the communists always are doing stuff like that. It's also important to note that it wasn't just van der Lubbe who was put on trial in a Weimar court. It's also important to note at this point, this was still the Weimar Republic. Hitler was a chancellor in a coalition government in which there was only three National Socialists in the cabinet. The rest were either independents or non-party affiliated or German nationalists. There was only three National Socialists in the cabinet. Hitler was the chancellor. It was a coalition government. President von Hindenburg was still the president, and the president in the Weimar Republic exercised considerable power. At any given time, he could fire Hitler, he could dissolve the Reichstag and call for new elections, or he could declare martial law. And several times in 1933 and 1934, President von Hindenburg threatened to declare martial law. And at this point in 33-34, the Reichswehr, which was the German army, was incredibly loyal to President von Hindenburg, and he enjoyed an incredible amount of popularity amongst the German populace. He was not, at this point, senile, contrary to how he's portrayed by court historians and the media. He was not feeble in March of 33. It wasn't until probably a couple of months before he died of cancer in August of 34 that he actually began to really go downhill. But be that as it may, in March of 1933, this Enabling Act was proposed to President von Hindenburg, which would allow the chancellor to rule by decree, and von Hindenburg refused to sign it. He said, take it to the Reichstag and get a vote. So Hitler took it to the Reichstag. At this point, the NSDAP did not have the absolute number of votes to pass it, so they would have needed votes not only from Hugenberg's German National Party, but also from the Catholic Center Party, which were hardly hardcore nationalists. They also would have needed a few votes from the Social Democrats, which were hardcore, party of the labor unions. This was one of the few times in which Hitler as chancellor engaged in a floor debate. You can find the video on the internet. I'm not sure it's on YouTube. I actually have a clip of it, but Hitler actually engaged in a floor debate with one of the Social Democrat members of parliament, of the Reichstag, their parliament. The Enabling Act was presented to the Reichstag, and it passed. It passed with the NSDAP votes. It passed with the Catholic Center Party voting for it. It passed with the Nationalist Party voting for it. And it passed with some Social Democrat votes. So this was not Hitler seizing power and anointing himself as the dictator. Even with the Enabling Act, President von Hindenburg still could have dissolved the Reichstag, called for new elections, and could have dismissed Hitler as chancellor. But let's read what the Reichstag, what the Enabling Act is. It's only four articles. It says, the Reichstag has enacted the following law, which is hereby proclaimed with the assent of the Reichstag, and having been established that its requirements for a constitutional amendment have been fulfilled. One. Now we see the Constitution was not suspended or done away with. They amended the Constitution. Article 1. In addition to the procedure prescribed by the Constitution, laws of the Reich may also be enacted by the government of the Reich. This includes the laws referred to by Articles 85, Paragraph 2, and Article 87 of the Constitution. Article 2. Laws enacted by the government of the Reich may deviate from the Constitution as long as they do not affect the institutions of the Reichstag or the Reichsrat. The Reichstag is the national parliament. The Reichsrat are the regional parliaments. The rights of the president remain unaffected. Now, that's important to note, because von Hindenburg could easily have dissolved the Reichstag and could have fired the chancellor still. Laws enacted by the Reich government shall be issued by the chancellor and announced in the Reich Gazette. Now, the Reich Gazette is equivalent to what we would call the Congressional Record. They shall take effect on the day following the announcement unless they prescribe a different date. Article 68 to 77 of the Constitution do not apply to laws enacted by the Reich government. Treaties of the Reich with foreign states which relate to matters of the Reich legislation shall, for the duration of the validity of these laws, not require the consent of the Reichstag. The Reich government shall adopt the necessary legislation to implement these agreements. Now, here's the kicker, which Charlie refused to bring up. This law enters into force on the day of its proclamation and expires on April 1st, 1937. It expires, furthermore, if the present Reich government is replaced by another, meaning if President von Hindenburg had 3 months later dissolved the Reichstag and fired the chancellor, or on April 1st, 1937. There was a sunset. Now, what Charlie didn't mention was in 1937, there was a referendum was held, and the German people voted by like 90-some-odd percent to extend the Enabling Act. So, right. You know, the actions that were implemented by Hitler during this period of time had the full force of law and were codified by a vote of the populace. They were extended by the vote of the populace. So, you know, they say that a lie by omission is a lie, and I think that Charles is being a little bit disingenuous with his propaganda that Hitler had basically seized power, made himself a dictator, when in fact he followed the constitutional process of the Weimar Constitution, and then when the law was about to sunset, he went to the people, and the people held a referendum and extended it in accordance with the law. So I wanted to debunk that right off the get-go. And then I want to get into his its situation regarding the situation with the Jewish question within Germany and whether or not he, did he go after all the Jews or some of the Jews or did he let the fat cat Jews off? Because that is utter rubbish. And I think we better start off with numbers. And these are numbers I'm quoting both from the last, I shouldn't say the last Weimar census. It was started under Weimar, and the National Socialist Government published it on June 16, 1933. But on June 16, 1933, a census was published that showed there was 505,000 Jews in Germany. Now, that is the German borders of 1933. There was a document published by Dr. Kante, and he was the director of the National Socialist Physicians Organization, and the document was called, and this is the English translations, Jews and Jewish Mischlinger in the German Reich, and what he was publishing was exactly how many Jews were in the German Reich in 1939, and he tracked the immigration. And what we're going to prove here is, contrary to Charles's point that they only went after chef or whatever, that all Jews were actually encouraged to leave and immigrate in that period, and that's the period I talked about, 1933 to 1939. It's a critical point. Actually, active immigration was being carried out and ongoing until December of 1941, and that's an important point to note, because the numbers that were laid out in the Wannsee Protocol demonstrate a very striking statistic. Anyway, in January there was actually 300,000 Mischlinger, according to Dr. Kante. So there was 505,000 Jews in Germany on June 16, 1933. This was a census that was published by the government on June 16, 1933. And January of 1942, as memorialized in the Wannsee Protocol, and I'm going to quote from that, there was 131,000 Jews remaining in Germany proper. And I'm going to read from the Wannsee Protocol, because they attribute that to immigration between 1933 and 1940-41, early 1941, at what they call active immigration until 1941. Now, that's a difference. If you take the 505,000 down to 131, that means they were able to get out of Germany proper. They were able to have an exodus of 374,000 Jews by immigration alone. I would say bravo. Bravo. Not one hair harmed on any of the Chosenites. Now, I don't consider that a Holocaust. Now, Charlie also points to this transfer, the ominous transfer agreement, as some sort of dark conspiracy between, you know, the Germans and the German government in 1933 on, and the I think we're going to break, so I'll pick it up on the other side.
Going to a 3-minute break. We'll be back in 3 minutes after a word from our sponsors. We are back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin, and he is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. That website is ana-ann.com, and the other website is wvfoundations.org. Okay, so
let me give you an example as to how bad the problem was. As we know, Jews generally cluster in the bigger cities, and in Germany, that would have been, say, Dresden, Berlin, Hamburg. Get the idea. In 1933, an organization called the General League of Anti-Communist Associations published a book called The Jewish Domination of Weimar Germany.
Right.
And they basically gathered statistics, and this was statistics at the time. And this gives you an idea. Now, keep in mind, we gave the total number of Jews in 1933 as reported on a report on June 16th of 1930. There was about a half a million Jews in Germany. But this is relating to Berlin. In Berlin, and this is a chart they have, they said 48% of medical men were Jews, 43% of school doctors were Jews, 68% of welfare doctors were Jews, 45% of hospital directors were Jews, 38% of dentists were Jews, 32% of chemists were Jews, 54% of lawyers were Jews, and by the way, that was a static number across Germany in general. They were just completely overrepresented. 80% of theater managers was Jews. Now, there you have the theater managers. I would equate that to today's Hollywood being dominated by Jews. 44% of head doctors were Jews. 50% of teachers in the medical faculty are Jews, and teachers in philosophical faculty was 25%. That was the lowest number that this organization cited. They had a Jewish problem. They were grossly overrepresented, given their percentage of the population. There was one other quote I wanted to put here: of 20 officials, 8 or 40% were of Jewish origin in the Berlin regional government. So, you know, I want to go through Charlie says that they really didn't go after the Jews. So I want to put kind of a chronology here that I want to go over. And then I actually want to get into the so-called transfer agreement, because basically all it was a finance ministry circular that waived a Weimar law that made their immigration policy more tenable and easy. But before we get into that, this was Hitler's statement on the floor of the Reichstag when the Enabling Act was passed. And this is Hitler speaking. By its decision to carry out the political and moral cleansing of our public life, the government is creating and securing the conditions for a really deep and inner religious life. The advantages for the individual may be derived from compromises with aesthetic organizations do not compare in any way with the consequences which are visible in the destruction of our common religious and ethical values. The government will treat all other denominations with
with objective and impartial justice. It cannot, however, tolerate allowing membership of a certain denomination or a certain race being used as a release from all common legal obligations or as a blank check for unpunishable behavior or for the toleration of crimes. The national government will allow and confirm the Christian denominations the enjoyment of their due influence in the schools and education, and it will be concerned for the sincere cooperation between the church and state. The struggle against the materialistic ideology and for the erection for the true people's community, the Volksgemeinschaft, serves as much the interests of the German nation as of our Christian faith. The national government, seeing in Christianity the unshakable foundation of the moral and ethical life of our people, attaches the utmost importance to the cultivation and maintenance of the friendliest relations with the Holy See. The rights of the churches will not be curtailed. Their position in relation to the state will not be changed. Now, I remember reading about Franklin Roosevelt saying that the National Socialists were going to replace Christianity and they were anti-Christian. But the fact of the matter is Christianity grew under the National Socialist government. It was smashed under the Allied Control Council when Allied officers that were actually Jews in army uniforms went around to all the Protestant and Catholic parishes around Germany and told them what they could and could not preach in 1945 and 46.
And of course, we all know that whenever the communists enter a country, that they round up a lot of the church officials and literally murder tens of thousands of them in every country that they enter.
Absolutely. Now, let me get into the core of Charlie's argument that the Germans really didn't, you know, Hitler didn't really, you know, was soft on the Jews, and he was a Jewish agent. Let me go through a chronology, and then I want to get into some of the actual legislation that was passed.
All right.
After the break.
We'll do that after the break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. All right, we are back. This is Deanna. Our guest is Rodney Martin, and we are talking about, go ahead, pick it up where we left off.
Now, one of Charlie's many claims, and like I said, he had a series, I think, four shows. We're not going to get into the bunker because we covered that already, Deanna, but we've covered some of his, we replied to some of his items already, but he said that basically Hitler was, you know, not really hard on the Jews. He went after some of the little ones, but not the big ones. But we're going to prove that wrong because between 1933 and 39, that was the first 6 years before the Polish campaign, the National Socialist government implemented 400 legal restrictions basically designed to force the Jews from German society to make them immigrate. Let's go through some of them. This begins in March of 33. The Berlin City Health Commissioner removed all Jewish doctors from the city social welfare services. Now, I don't consider doctors to be small pickings at all. On April 7th of 33, all Jews were removed from the professional and civil service in the government of both the national, which would be the Reichstag, and then in the regional governments. Also, on April 7th, they passed, these are all in the Reich Law Gazette, and this is what I mean about using original sources. It takes a little time. You have to go online in some places, you know, and you know, maybe use a translator to, because some of these documents are still in German. But on April 7th, the government passed two laws. One was the law for the restoration of the professional civil service, and that actually removed all Jews from government service, all of them. And then on the same day, they passed a law for the admission to the legal profession, and that kicks all Jews out of the legal profession in Germany. Now, I don't consider those Jews to be, you know, small fish either. And that was Charles Giuliani's claim, is that Hitler didn't go, only went after the small fish. Well, you know, within, 3 months of becoming chancellor,
They've been kicked out of the medical and legal and judicial and government service in just a couple of months. On April 25th, the law against overcrowding in schools and universities that limited Jewish students in public schools, and then 2 months later they were kicked out of German schools. July 14th, the denaturalization law revoked the citizenship of naturalized Jews and other undesirables. That was Jews that had immigrated to Germany and acquired German citizenship under prior governments. They were actually revoked. Now, that is something the United States should do. On October 4th, the law on editors bans Jews from the editorial posts. Kind of interesting. Are we seeing a trend here, Deanna? Systematically, step by step by step, the National Socialist government under Hitler they're not going after just a little small fish Jews. They're going after the kingfish. On May 21st, 1935, the Reichswehr, because it didn't become the Wehrmacht until later in 1935, expelled all Jewish officers from the army. On September 15th, this is the famous Nuremberg race laws, and this is where all Jews were expelled from German citizenship and prohibited from marrying or having sexual relations with persons of German or German-related blood. On January the 11th, 1936, an executive order was issued from the Reich's tax office that forbid Jews from serving as tax consultants. On April 3rd, Jews could no longer be veterinarians. On October 15th, the Reich Education Ministry banned all Jewish teachers from the education profession, with the exception of Jewish schools. On April 9th, 1937, the mayor of Berlin orders public schools not to admit any Jewish children until further notice. That remained in effect until after the war. On January of 1938, this is when the famous law for the alteration of family and personal names, which forbid Jews from taking Aryan names, i.e. hiding in German, within German society. On February 5th that same year, the law on the profession of auctioneer excluded Jews from being auctioneers. So, you know, what we're seeing here is, contrary to what Charles Giuliani said, the German government actually started at the top and then worked its way down. They started at the government, the legal, the medical, and education profession. Now they're down to veterinarians and auctioneers. On March 18th, Jews were forbidden to be gun merchants, and this was 1938. On April 22nd, the decree against the camouflage of Jewish firms, which forbids the change in the names of Jewish owned business. That means that it prevented Jews from hiding their assets. On April 26th, the order for the disclosure of Jewish assets, it required the Jews to report all property in excess of 5,000 Reichsmarks. On July 11th, the Reich Finance Ministry and the Reich Interior Ministry banned Jews from health spas. It means they couldn't go into the same spas as Aryans. On August 17th, an executive order on the law for the alteration of family and personal names requires Jews bearing the names of non-Jewish origin to adopt the name Israel for men and Sarah for women. I don't think I need to go any further, Deanna, but let me skip forward here. On December 30th, 1938, all Jewish shops were closed and curfews were imposed on Jews. And on February 21st, 1939, the decree was issued requiring Jews to surrender precious metals and stones in Jewish ownerships. On August 1st, the German lottery was forbidden to sell lottery tickets. Yes, Germany, National Socialist Germany had a lottery. Jews could not purchase lottery tickets. So, contrary to Charles's statements, the German National Socialist government did not just target the little small fish. They actually started at the top and then worked their way down in an effort to first force the big fish out of Germany and then force the little fish out as well. And that takes me to his
discussion about the transfer agreement. And a lot of people make a much ado about nothing regarding the so-called transfer agreement. Now, the Jews have their own name for the transfer agreement, but what the transfer agreement really is a Reich Finance Ministry circular number 54, 1933. And what that was about was it had to figure out a way to where they can pursue their immigration policies. Keep in mind, the Germans wanted to get the Jews out of Germany. They were not, and this runs, you know, all in document after document in the German archives. You see the Germans saying, how do we get the Jews out of the country, and how do we make them pay for it as well? But they had a problem. In 1931, the Weimar government passed a very, very tough flight tax, which, by the way, the IRS has in the United States and a lot of other countries has as well, which means people leaving the country had to pay a very large and stiff tax based on your net worth and your assets to leave the country. And actually, it was passed on December the 8th, 1931, and it was assessed based upon the departure of the individual's domicile, provided the individual had assets exceeding 200,000 Reichsmark. Well, there were a lot of people that were leaving Weimar, particularly after the 1929 crash. They were running off to either France, England, or the United States. That law remained on the books actually until 1953. The National Socialists wanted a way to ease that exit tax to get the Jews out of Germany, so they would actually create some sort of mechanism to where they would speed up immigration, get the maximum number of Jews out of Germany, and therefore they would pay for it themselves. So they have this circular, which is later became known as the transfer agreement, which a lot of people, like Charles, considered it to be. Well, there they are. There's the Zionists and there's the Germans working together. They must be Jewish agents. As a matter of fact, there's a famous quote by Reinhard Heydrich where he says, as a National Socialist and a German, I am a Zionist. And he chuckled and laughed because he said it in context. And it's important to put things in context, is that it was a quick way of getting rid of the Jews and getting them out of Germany and eventually out of Europe. Let's read this Reich Finance Ministry circular and see if it's very, if it in any way indicates that Hitler and the National Socialists were agents. To further the cause of Jewish immigration to Palestine through allocation of the necessary sums of money without putting too much strain on the currency reserves of the Reich. Hello? That means let's get rid of the Jews and have them pay for it and not have us pay for it, and simultaneously increasing German exports. An agreement has been reached with the appropriate Jewish authorities. It is based on the following conditions. Immigrants, on whose behalf the Immigration Advisory Office confirms that the further sums of money are necessary and adequate for the purpose of starting a new life in Palestine, and that the minimum amount of 1,000 Palestinian pounds required for the immigration into Palestine is insufficient, may be granted an additional sum in excess of the 15,000 Reichsmarks on condition that it is paid at the Reichsbank into a special account of the Bank of the Temple Corporation, German Colonist Bank in Palestine, and credited to a trust company in Palestine specially set up for the purpose, or to the Anglo-Palestine Bank until the Jewish Trust Company can be set up. A total sum of 3 million Reichsmarks has been designated initially for the special account and for the second account mentioned below. It is to be operated by the Temple Bank as a trust account for the above-mentioned Jewish Trust Company. This account is to be used to pay for German goods delivered to Palestine. Immigrants will be paid the equivalent of their deposits by the Palestine Trust Company according to the funds available from the sale of German goods to Palestine. This will occur in the order and proportion of the payments made into the special account and paid out to the Palestine and paid out in Palestine pounds. The Palestinian, and it goes into the name of the firm set up. It says, Palestine Trust Office for Advice to German Jews has been founded in Berlin, Friedrichstrasse 218, to advise German Jews in matters concerning this form of capital transfer to Palestine. It says, furthermore, a special account has been opened at the Reichsbank on behalf of the Bank of the Temple Organization on application. The exchange regulation authorities may grant permission to German Jewish nationals who have not yet immigrated but who already planning a new existence in Palestine to deposit up to 50,000 Reichsmarks per person into this account and similarly credit it into the German Jewish Trust Company to be founded in Palestine or to the Anglo-Palestine Bank until this has been found. Now, this circular was in effect until to the outbreak of the war with Poland in 1939. There is nothing conspiratorial about it. What it did was basically allow a waiver on the Weimar flight tax, and it allowed also the sale of, you know, so they can actually, one, allow for additional funds to exit and get them Jews out of the country, and also to purchase goods for supplies when they left and went to Palestine. Now, I have a philosophical problem with the Jews going to Palestine because they were actually stealing somebody else's property. I have a problem with that.
Exactly.
The fact of the matter is the Brits were letting them in. They were going there, and the Germans wanted them out. The transfer agreement, however, as presented by Charlie, was not some sort of conspiratorial agreement, developed in a smoke, filled room between Hitler and some grand rabbi poobah. It was actually a circular aimed at waiving certain provisions of the Weimar flight tax law, which the National Socialist government kept in place for other reasons. I wanted to address that. Let's go into
It was also an economic situation. It countered the economic assault by international Jewry, and so the international Jews that were waging this economic warfare against Germany did not like the transfer agreement because it countered it. And so it was helping the economy, the German economy, because the people that took the money and went to Palestine had to agree to use that money to buy goods from Germany. And then they stopped the transfer agreement because after 60,000 Jews did go to Palestine, and then Germany reconsidered exactly what they were doing, and in fact, I think I can't remember who said it, but when they stopped it, they said, "We really don't want them to congregate in another country, but to be scattered, and if they are congregated in another country, let's let it be Madagascar or something like that." I mean,
right. Right. The interestingly, the Zionist, I can envision now the Zionist mob squad at least had a plan to put the Jews someplace other than Europe.
Exactly.
And again, I object to them stealing the Palestinians' land, and the Germans, quite frankly, wanted them someplace other
yes.
than Germany and Europe. And obviously, here's the problem with the logic of the Holocaust fraudsters, is here you have documents that show the Germans said, okay, take your people to Palestine, but we don't, but we're going to waive the exit tax laws, but at the same time, German firms, you're going to buy German exports to supply your efforts. And guess what? The Zionists went for it.
Right.
And but it was not some sort of grand conspiracy at all, by any means. And I want to go back, fast forward a little bit to the text of the Wannsee Protocol, because on page 2 of the transcript it says the chief aims of the National Socialist policy has been, and the essential points actually says, has been the following: one, the expulsion of Jews from every sphere of life of the German people; two, the expulsion of Jews from the living space of the German people. And then it goes on, to make all necessary arrangements for the preparation for the increased immigration of Jews from Germany, and to direct the flow of immigration, and to speed the procedure of immigration in each individual case.
Now, this is where some people get wrapped up in the Wannsee. There's a follow-up point, and I'll put it out here. The aim of this was to cleanse German living space of Jews in a legal manner. Now, the term cleanse is not meant to be execution, annihilation, or Holocaust.
All righty. We are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. And he is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. That website is ANA-ANN.com. The other website is WVFoundations.org. Okay.
Deanna, I know we're getting ready to get into the third hour, and that's when we're going to take calls. And I want to encourage people to call if I've missed something that I didn't address for that Charlie had brought up. But I want to bring up one other point. Charlie had brought up that Hjalmar Schacht was a Jew, and Alfred Rosenberg was a Jew. And let me address that real briefly. First of all, we got to be real careful of calling people Jews simply because their last name sounds Jewish or because of their profession. First of all, Rosenberg was not a Jew. It was well known. He was a Baltic German, and I would encourage people, you know, he's famous for his book, Myth of the 20th Century, but I think also people should, there's another book called Political Essays by Alfred Rosenberg, and he has an essay in that book called An Anti-Semitic International, and it was published in the National Socialist Party newspaper on April 14th, 1921. And it goes to show you how far back Rosenberg went in the party. He was one of the earliest members, went back with Hitler back in the early days. But he talks about an anti-Semitic international. And quite frankly, I advocate an international anti-Semitic international as well to confront international Jewry. We got to stop fighting each other and arguing over petty little, you know, conspiracy theories and confront the real enemy. And, you know, one of Charlie's flaws, Charlie is great on the, and he understands the Jews are the enemy. The problem is he falls into this, you know, rat trap that everybody and everything who takes an active role against Jewry must be a Jewish agent. And that is problematic, because if everybody and everything, particularly like Germany and Hitler, are Jewish agents, then we can't organize or challenge Jewry, because somebody like Charlie will come along and say, oh, they must be a Jewish agent, so we just got to sit behind our computers and do podcasts and attack everybody and everything, because anybody that actually organizes an opposition must be a Jew. And I dare say that Charlie's attitude in that respect presents him to be a Jewish agent than anything else, because all he's doing is creating hate and discontent and disunity and preventing us from formalizing an organized resistance. And I dare say that National Socialist Germany was the last effective organized resistance to international Jewry. Now, I am not I'm criticizing Charlie's thesis on his Hitler shows. I'm not going to, you know, some people have called on me to kick him off ANN. I'm not going to do that. I don't engage in censorship. I don't require our hosts to turn in their scripts and for me to review. But I do reserve the right to disagree and to call out absolute hogwash. And his Hitler series was hogwash, absolutely hogwash. I don't know what his sources were, because he did not cite very many sources. But another, you know, point that I want to go to, fully refute, well, I'll bring it up after the break.
Okay, we'll do that after the break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. That website is ANA-ANN.com. The other website is WVFoundations.org. And I would like to state for the record that RBN has been incredibly, very tolerant to allow us to to discuss something that is so controversial. So I do think, well, we owe RBN, at least I believe that I do, because RBN has given me a voice for, about 4 years now. And I really appreciate it. And I've talked about a lot of very, very controversial things that I never could have said anywhere else. So, thank you, John Stadtmiller. Okay.
Well, let me echo that, Deanna, because it's easy for people to go on and turn on a mic and, you know, do the Hitler bashing and the German bashing because that's, you know, fashionable. Hollywood does it. It's another thing for a network to give 3 hours to a couple of original source historians. And what we're doing is providing – I'm citing original source documents. And, you know – court legal judgments, both criminal and civil, are based on original source documents. And I have sitting on my desk in front of me, it's covered with copies that I printed out, and you can probably hear the paper shuffling as I go through, copies of original source documents that would be admissible in a court of law to make the case. And that's all I'm doing. And people are going to have to decide if they're going to allow Hollywood fiction to form their opinions and live in fantasy land. And, you know, I don't think that's worked out very well for our society, or they're going to allow, you know, facts. And sometimes facts can be, you know, a startling, you know, revelation. But I want to get back, as you know, getting back to this, you know, Hitler was a Jew agent and served the Jews' interest. And in fact, the National Socialist challenged the Jewish narrative, challenged the Jewish banking system, the coming of the New World Order from the very beginning. And once they got in after from 1940, you know, the stakes were very high. And, you know, as I said, Alfred Rosenberg was not a Jew. Hjalmar Schacht was not a Jew either. And let me cover him. Hjalmar Schacht had been a Weimar banking economics official. Hitler retained him in the early years of the National Socialist government in the finance ministry for the sole purpose of using Schacht's connections with the American economic machine to renegotiate the Weimar debt that the National Socialists had inherited. Once Schacht had accomplished that, he was phased out and was replaced by Walther Funk as finance minister. Walther Funk was a protege of Gottfried Feder, who is the champion of third way economists and anti-usury people like me. And Walther Funk then took over, and Walther Funk gave a speech on July 25th, 1940, and he called it the Economic Reorganization of Europe. And I would encourage people to read that speech. If you don't have it, if you can't find it, write me and I'll send you a PDF copy. I'm not going to go, it's a long speech, but you can hear Funk challenging on behalf of the National Socialist government, challenging the Jewish system. And let me read 4 points that he, as he was summarizing his speech. By concluding long-term economics agreements with European countries. You notice he's not saying anything about imposing anything. Keep in mind, in 1940, Germany was sitting in very good position in July. France had been conquered. They were in the Balkans by then, and they were posed to take down, they're preparing to take down Russia. They'd already formed agreements with Romania, Hungary. I mean, they were in a good position in 1940. By concluding long-term economic agreements with European countries, it will be possible to assign a place for the German market in the long-term production planning of these countries, i.e. as a safe export outlets will be found to exist for German goods in European markets. By creating stable exchange rates, a smooth working system of payments must be assured for the carrying on of trade between individual countries. In so doing, we will link up with the existing payment agreements, which will be expanded to include greater volume of trade on the basis of stable exchange rates. And then he goes on, a stronger sense of economic community among European nations must be aroused by collaboration in all spheres of economic policy. the economic consolidation of European countries can improve by their bargaining position in dealings with other economic groups in the world economy. A Europe will not submit to political and economic terms dictated to it by any extra body. Now, do you hear what he's saying? He's saying no European Union. He's preserving, they're talking about preserving the concept of nation state. They're talking about unilateral trade between one nation state to another to another. This is something that they're talking about. No World Trade Organization, none of these NAFTA-like agreements. They're talking about trade between nation states. And he's talking about this in terms of the economic reorganization of Europe after the war. Of course, that didn't happen. You see, you know, there is empirical evidence in these documents of what the National Socialists planned on after the war. They were going to preserve the nation state. There was going to be, we often hear about fair trade. Well, they were the champions of fair trade. They had a barter system where they would trade German machinery and tractors for coffee down in Latin America. This was catching on like wildfire, and it drove the Jewish banking cabal bananas. And Charlie Giuliani completely did not speak to that. If Hitler was such a Jewish agent, why was he not only removing them politically, socially, geopolitically, but also attacking their economic stranglehold on the world affairs? People missed the point that the National Socialists, you know, by 1939, before the Polish campaign, they were breaking the Jewish stranglehold on international trade by their barter system, not only in Europe, but in across the world as well. And so Charles completely did not address that that point at all.
Right.
Go ahead.
You know, with Schock too. The only reason that Hitler put Schock in was because he had business connections. But when Schock wanted to alter the flow and the creation of the currency that had helped to make the country resurrect the country, and also. Well, that's when Hitler dismissed him. But Federer was also an assistant, and the only reason that that Schacht was put in and Federer was the assistant was because of Federer's health.
Absolutely. Federer was in ill health. He died in 1940. He was the undersecretary state and the finance ministry from Schacht's term through Funk's term, and then in 1938 he became a taught part-time at the University of Munich, and he died a year and a half later. He was in poor health. But his economic model eclipsed Schott and Funk.
Exactly.
And implemented it. So for people to say, and this was one of the disagreements I had with Anthony Michaels when he said that usury was still practiced in National Socialist Germany, but he couldn't prove it. that was kind of interesting to say, oh, yeah, it happened, but I can't prove it. When actually the evidence shows to the contrary, is rather interesting. And the same goes with people like Michaels, and even Charlie, to a certain extent, reminds me of these old Jewish Holocaust, purported Holocaust survivors that say, "Well, if I believe it in my mind, it must have been real," and it's just not the case. It's not the case at all. And you know, I wanted to get into some of the actual language and some of the laws. I don't think that is necessary. One of the points that Charlie went into great detail on, and I'm going to skip around some more here, was he talked about the summer of 1941, you know, and the trade between the United States and Germany before the United States and Germany went to war on December the 11th, 1941. And he seems to think that is some kind of smoking gun. And he talked about, you know, tanker shipments out of Aruba and the Caribbean and such. And, you know, I want to, you know, but he cited no sources. I have some sources, and I want to talk about that, because the fact of the matter was there were U-boat attacks on tanker shipments, but not until after there was a declaration of war and when the Americans were actually in the war. But let me bring up some sources first. There is an excellent book called Führer's Conferences on Naval Affairs, 1939 to 1945, and it's basically a book of transcript. Martin is a Jewish name. I wonder who thinks that. Somebody really, actually, it's a German name. But some people have too much time on their hands. But they should get out more. But there is a this book is a list of transcripts of the conferences between the naval adjutants and the naval representatives to Hitler's headquarters, particularly the adjutant to Admiral Puttkamer, and when they would give briefings on naval affairs. And there is a particular transcript that took place when they gave a naval report to Hitler on March 18, 1941. Also present was the chief of staff of the OKW, General Jodl, and Commander von Puttkamer. And they talk about the situation with the Americans basically engaging in warfare with Germany. The fact that Roosevelt was attacking, having destroyers escorting British shipping as far as Iceland, which was outside the neutrality zone of the United States, that some of these American destroyers had fired on German shipping. And they were making the case as far back as March of 41 that they needed to respond, that these American ships are firing on German ships. And as early as March of 41, Hitler was saying, no, they are neutral. We're not going to create another Lusitania incident because the Jew media and the United States will spin it the other way around. Keep in mind, the German submarine in 1917 had every right to sink the Lusitania. It was loaded with contraband, with war supplies. We know that now. Because divers have gone into the wreck of the Lusitania, and there's guns. I mean, there's contraband in the cargo hold. However, they don't talk about it. But Hitler was correct. He said they are declared their neutrality. If we do something, they will lie. And Roosevelt was actually even lying in April. In May of 41, he was given radio addresses saying that German submarines had fired on an American ship, the USS Greer. It never happened. Just like Lyndon Johnson talked in the Gulf of Tonkin saying that North Vietnamese had fired on a U.S. ship. It never happened. Americans lie. American governments lie. And so Hitler had resisted requests from the naval commanders to return fire, and as early as March of 41. But in the meantime, it was not illegal for certain pre-existing contracted shipments. Royal Dutch Shell, for instance, had shipments going into Europe, even though Europe was occupied under German occupation, and there was some shipments going in and out, say Venezuela. Venezuela is an oil-rich country, and they would go in and through and around Aruba sometimes. But Charlie made this point that certain tankers were fired upon and they weren't. Well, here's the point. No American ships were fired upon prior to the declaration of war. No American flag tankers or American flag were fired upon by German submarines. And as a matter of fact, let me give a little factoid. There were no American ships fired upon until February of 1942. And that was when there was an attack, Operation Neuland, which was carried out by U-156, actually fired, actually attacked an oil refinery, which was at Aruba, and fired on some ships. That was the first attack by a German U-boat, and it attacked a refinery, and it also attacked American ships. But by then, the United States had been at war in the United States with Germany for 2 months. But there were no. So Charlie's assumption that because Germans weren't torpedoing tankers in the Caribbean in the summer of 1941, as he stated on his show, I believe that's what he said, the summer of 41 in the run-up, or in 1941, is kind of erroneous because the Germans didn't attack anyone except British ships up until 1941.
Exactly, after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. I mean, but there was no American, ships attacked until February. The first reported American ship was in February of 42, and that had to do with logistics. They just didn't, the U-boats didn't have, U-boats have to have a target to shoot at. But there were British flagships routinely sunk in the Caribbean, between 39 through 41 and throughout the war. But the first Americans that they had the opportunity to shoot at was in February of 42. Mm-hmm. So his chronology is even off. I don't know where he got the idea that because, you know, prior to December 11th, 1941, there was no American tankers, torpedoed, that, you know, that was a problem. Well, if they were flying an American flag, according to Hitler's orders in his naval conferences, and I would encourage people to get that book, Führer's Conferences on Naval Affairs, there was explicit orders, if a ship had the American flag, they did not get attacked. Period.
Right, right.
So there's a problem with his chronology and with his assumption, because Hitler, the Germans respected the neutrality, the American neutrality, for a specific reason. He, you know, they understood. They did not want a repeat of the Lusitania. Now, I have said I have been critical of the Germany honor going to war with the United States on December 11, 41. There was two reasons. One, the pretext was to honor the commitment to Japan, and I think that was a poor commitment because Japan could have massed troops on the Siberian border and tied up the Siberian troops that Stalin rushed up to save Moscow. I would not, if I was a Germans, I would not have honored that commitment because Japan was a worthless ally. That is one of the criticisms I have. Now, Charlie may refer to me as one of the Hitler worshippers, but I think there was some tactical mistakes, and I think one of them was honoring, going to war with the United States under the auspice of honoring a commitment to Japan, because Japan was utterly worthless in terms of an ally. You know, Japan could have massed troops on the Siberian border. Stalin would not have moved his Siberian troops, and Moscow would have fallen. And if Moscow would have fallen, the Soviet war effort would have collapsed. There's just little doubt of that. Stalin's ability to hold power would have been very much in trouble. So I have problems with Hitler engaging the United States and bringing its industrial capacity into the war when he still had Britain in the West and the Soviets not knocked out in the East. I think that was a problem. And I think that's something that is a legitimate criticism, because to honor a commitment to Japan when Japan wasn't honoring its commitments is bad strategy.
Yes. All righty. We will be back in 3 minutes. All righty. We are back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network, and that website is ana-ann.com. In defense of the issue with Japan, there's a very good book. It's written by Edward S. Miller, and it's called Bankrupting the Enemy, the U.S. Financial Siege of Japan Before Pearl Harbor, which began occurring at about the very same time. And of course, when you're talking about the U.S. siege against Japan, you are talking about the Japanese economic, or the Jewish economic assault against Japan prior to World War II. So what the Jews did was that they waged an economic warfare against both Japan, beginning quite early, and Germany, actually at about the same time. So Japan was not in a position to do much of anything with regards to being a fair partner or ally of Germany, because somebody was holding the purse strings.
I think you're correct, Deanna. I think that Japan's grievances with the United States were absolutely correct. I think they were left with little other options than to do what they did. You know, people, there's been not a whole lot reviewed on the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere, which Japan was advocating, which is very similar to what the National Socialists were advocating for Europe. I just wish Japan would have massed some troops on the Siberian border to just make Stalin think that they were going to do something there just until after the winter of 41. What a difference that would have made if Moscow would have fallen. What a difference. But one other point I want to bring up, again, this goes to Charles's claim that they Hitler was not strong on, you know, going after the Jews and the big fish and all that. And I came across this case, and I actually had a friend of mine in Germany send me some information on it. And this was a case of Leo Katzenberger. Now, by the way, Katzenberger is a Jewish name. Martin is not. So, you know, whoever's sending those emails, really, they really do need to get out more. But yes, this is where I talked about earlier about sometimes you can, you know, accomplish two goals or kill two birds with the same stone. And this is where we're going to do some Holocaust debunking as well. Leo Katzenberger was a big-time Jewish businessman in Nuremberg. And he had some major business operations. And anyway, in July of 1941, now he was 76 years old then, and he was a complaint was filed that he was having sexual relations with a 30-year-old German woman and violation of the Nuremberg laws and also a law called the Law Against Racial Defilement. And now, again, this is where Charles, you have to keep in mind, Charles's worldview and his philosophy has to be taken into account. Now, he widely criticized, and I think if you listen to his series, most of his diatribes had to do with the fact that the National Socialists called for a strong state and that they were against individual liberties. He talked very libertarian, which I come down on the side of the National Socialist. I think there is a strong, you know, if you're going to have an ethno state, then you're going to have an ethno state. And so I come down to the side of National Socialism and against libertarianism because, quite frankly, libertarianism, American libertarianism, is what's gotten us into the trouble that we're in the United States now, not liberalism. It's this rugged individualism, and everybody can do whatever they want and defile themselves and tell everybody it's okay to do whatever you want. That's where we've gotten in trouble. But in this Katzenberg case, and it was adjudicated. Anyway, he was 76 years old, and he was accused of having relations with a 30-year-old German female. And apparently it was either her mother or father that they like to use the term denounced him. You know, that's the term that the Jews use, that basically the parents said, you know, turned him in. It went to trial. And now what's interesting about this is it's a testament to a few things. First of all, he was arrested, put on trial, but this takes place in July of 1941. He was a prominent Jew. He was not in a concentration camp, and this takes place after the Wannsee Conference, which the Holocaustersall say, you know, was a blueprint for genocide. So, you know, here if you look at just this Katzenberger case, Deanna, first of all, it debunks Charles's theory that the Germans didn't go after the big fish because they did. By the way, after his sentence was death. But also, she was, her name was Seeler, and she was actually found guilty of perjury and was punished as well. So, you know, the justice system seemed to work. But in this case, it debunked Charles's claim that the big fish were not pursued in Germany. It also reaffirms that Germany had a very robust legal system, but it also shows that the Wannsee Conference, you know, this takes place several months after Wannsee, that these Jews weren't in some, extermination camp. The fact of the matter
was
he was on trial. He was put on trial and given a trial.
Exactly. All righty. We're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty, we are back. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network, and that website is ANA-ANN.com. Okay.
Anyway, again, to wrap up on the, you know, lessons of this Katzenberger case, is it also, you know, not only does it destroy the Halle hoax argument, because here you have this Jew that was in Nuremberg and he was put on trial for violating the Nuremberg laws and went through the legal system, but also the German female was put on trial, and they were both found guilty because she lied to the court. You know, we had the 76-year-old, she was tried on multiple charges, but the court, I have a actual copy of the court's verdict, and they were both punished. So contrary, this also debunks Charles's argument that it was just a evil dictatorship, and because the German justice system punished her as well for lying to the court and for breaking the law. So not only did it punish the Jew for breaking the law, but it punished the German for breaking the law as well. Now, granted, the Jew got this more severe sentence. He lost his head, the one above his shoulders, and she was put in forced labor, hard labor camp for 2 years and lost her civil rights for 2 years. But in any event, here you have a situation that it shows that, you know, here you have this very, you know, prominent Jew that had a big business, and he was tried, went through a trial, and was executed as late as 1942. But why was, according to the Halle hoax religion, he shouldn't have been on trial. He shouldn't have been in Nuremberg. He should have been in Auschwitz. So, I mean, it's kind of it's just kind of odd. I like it when we're able to debunk two silly narratives at once. Now, there was another I lost some of my papers here, but I still wanted to bring up again, this goes to I'm deviating a little bit and address from the Jew agent, because there's no way any rational person can make the case and substantiate it that the National Socialist government was a Jew operation or a Jew front. Now, it's true that the Jews continue to thrive off of it, but not in the way that Charles outlined, Deanna. The Jews thrive off it because, you know, the old Rahm Emanuel statement that you never let any incident, you always capitalize on any incident. Right. You know, think about it. They created this false narrative about a Halle hoax that never happened. And some 70 years after the end of the war, which they're all celebrating and commemorating this week, they still use it. I mean, they are still hunting down. Now they're hunting down kids who were put in as camp guards at 15 and 16 so they can divert the adult camp guards as soldiers at the end of the war. They're hunting them down and charging them with 350,000 counts of manslaughter at the age of 95.
Well, they have to keep this up in order to keep up the farce.
Now, if all of these were Jewish agents, I mean, why? The only way that the Jews benefit from it is that they use it. You know, they're dancing. They're still dancing on the dead body of the National Socialist system and the National Socialist body to reap benefit from it that they're not entitled to, not entitled to at all. That's where they. That's the benefit that they're getting from it. They're not getting any benefit. I mean, Charles's theory is that Hitler did all of this to benefit the Jews. That is so asinine. That is like saying that the rooster crows to make the sun come up. I mean, that is absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. It's false logic, to say the least. That would mean, according to Charles's logic, that all of the other city-states, nation-states in history, and I think there's been 715 of them, I think, correct me with the correct number, Deanna, if you know it, that have expelled Jews from their jurisdictions and from their societies, have all been Jewish agents as well and have done that to help the Jews.
Well,
I don't think that's accurate.
Yes, there have been 109 times when I think 79 countries threw them out in the last 1,000 years. And in fact, when they were attempting to, when they held the Evian Convention to figure out what to do about this situation, none of the countries that actually attended the conference wanted to change their immigration policy. None of the countries really wanted them.
Well, of course not. I mean, nobody has ever wanted them. You know, you had the famous, I can't remember the name of the ship in 1940 that tried to dock in New York, and
Exodus?
Roosevelt's immigration department turned it away and ended up going back to Europe. And not,
right.
You know, there for a while, you know, they up until late 1940, a lot of them were able to get into Cuba through Cuba, but still, who wanted them? And I think that's a testament in and of itself. And yet you have a lot of non-Jews that like to play Jew and suck up to the Jews that get on their high horse about how all of these atrocities against the Jews, but yet they didn't want them either.
Well, most of the atrocity, it was just propaganda, and most of that was produced by the Allies. Before the war even ended, it was produced by people like Ilya Ehrenberg and other people, and of course that was to cover cover the butts of the Allies, who had gone in and absolutely destroyed a country that they should have been fighting with instead of against.
You know, I wanted to cover one statement that Charlie made, and it's going to be kind of quasi-controversial. He was making a much ado about, you know, Chevron doing business, and of course, and other American companies. And you know, I have never denied that American companies did business with Germany, but that ended in December of 1941. There was no more. All of those business interests ceased with the with the war. The GM's ownership in Opel, which they acquired in the 30s, that ceased. Now they reacquired it after the war, but I have never been one to deny that there was Americans were doing business in Germany, you know, in the 30s and right up until the outbreak of the war.
Everybody was doing business wherever they could. But the book that he used was written by a Jew.
Absolutely.
I've got it. It was written by, who was it, Charles Higham. And really it just put a different spin on things. And,
yeah, but there is no evidence, Deanna. There is zero evidence, and it's farcical.
Exactly.
To say that Chevron or Standard Oil was supplying oil to Germany
during the
war, that is bogus. That is absolutely bogus and false. And see, Charles had made he co-mingles. He'll make a statement that sounds official. And then he follows it up and he says, and just think, this company was supplying these Nazis supplies where our soldiers over there fighting them. And
he
basically makes a statement and then he follows up with an emotionally charged oversimplification. Well, first of all, I frankly wouldn't have cared if the Germans were getting supplies from American companies where our soldiers over there stupidly fighting the wrong enemy, you know, the wrong war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the enemy was in the White House. You know, the troops should have been storming the White House. You know, they should have. You know, there was discussions among, you know, forced retired American officers about kicking Roosevelt out.
Sure.
So, you know what? I shed no tears. I don't believe in the concept of the greatest generation, because the greatest generation went over and fought the wrong war against the wrong people, and then they came home. And they got fat and sassy, and they gave us multiculturalism,
They stood by and allowed schools to be forcibly integrated. They stood by and gave us the night, stood by and drank their martinis and sat around the pools while we had this, everything unraveled in the 1960s. So I don't consider, you know, Brokaw's Greatest Generation to be anything great at all. So when I heard Charlie make the, of everything Charlie said during that series, his outrage that some supplies got through while our soldiers were over there fighting the Germans, he was so outraged. You know what? I wouldn't have cared if that did happen. Now, the fact of the matter is it didn't happen. The fact of the matter is what Charlie didn't mention, and we have about 20 minutes left, was Hermann Göring took over war and economic planning, and he developed what was called the four-year plan. Right. Hermann Göring is made out to be a fat buffoon, stupid, ignoramus. They make fun of him because he liked fancy uniforms. But the fact of the matter is, Göring earned those medals and uniforms. Hermann Göring, if you go to the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., you'll see a list of pilots with the most kills. And you'll see Baron Manfred von Richthofen up there with his number of kills, and he has a big plaque. But they cannot deny Hermann Göring is up there in the top five, and his name is there very, very small. Hermann Göring was awarded the Pour le Mérite. Hermann Göring earned his medals and earned his uniforms. He was also very bright. Now, he did get addicted to painkillers because he got shot up. He was wounded. Mm-hmm. There's no denying that. Nobody's ever denied that. Now, when he got off the pills, we saw him shine at Nuremberg, and here you have this World War One German ace made a complete fool out of Mr. Justice Robert Jackson. Right. And, you know, they don't like showing that video clip. The fact of the matter, even with the trial being stacked as a kangaroo court, Hermann Göring won the exchange with Robert Jackson. In a modern court, with the proper rules, with proper evidentiary rules, with proper rules of procedure, Göring would have been acquitted. All of those guys would have been acquitted at Nuremberg. That is a fact that cannot be denied. If somebody says Göring was a Jew, according to Charles, and I haven't heard Charles say that Göring was a Jew, but he wasn't. But Göring developed what was called the four-year plan. Mm-hmm. Now, they have accused Göring of being corrupt and stealing everything and whatever. That's factually incorrect. What Göring also had a representative at the Wannsee Conference, and his name was Neumann. And Neumann made the strongest case at the Wannsee Conference, and I encourage people to print out a copy of the Wannsee Protocol. It's a transcript is what it is. It's on my website at WV Foundations under Reference Library. But Neumann made the strongest case about the need for labor for the armaments, and that was to basically review who was left of the Jews that hadn't immigrated or were being moved into ghettos and to the east. And by the way, ghettos were not a German creation; they were a Jewish creation. Jews had lived in ghettos in Romania and Hungary and Poland for centuries. Germans just utilized their own living arrangements to basically remove them from German society. Well, anyway, Neumann had used the fact, you know, to use them in labor. Well, anyway, Göring created the four-year plan to make Germany self-sufficient beginning. You know, the four-year plan kicked off in 1940, 1941. And this was the advent of synthetic material, synthetic fuel, synthetic rubber. So Germany would not be dependent on foreign materials. There are speeches you can go to on YouTube and you can get their English translated where Göring is talking about the four-year plan and the need for Germany to be completely self-sufficient in terms of materials. Yes, soap, lampshades, shrunken heads, all of that was determined to be false, not by any revisionist historians, but by the American occupation governor determined that there was no soap, there was no lampshades, and there was no shrunken heads. That's a historical fact, but yet the Jews still talk about that. I'm responding to a
comment in the chat room. But anyway, Charles Giuliani did not even talk about the four-year plan. The fact of the matter is the Germans would not have needed the four-year plan if they were getting all of this raw material covertly from the United States during the war. The Germans would not have spent an enormous amount of manpower in Romania keeping the Romanian oil fields open, because they were, you know, they were utilizing Romanian oil fields when they actually failed to capture oil fields in the Soviet Union. Right. So this whole nonsense that Germany was getting oil and materials from the United States was silly. Now, somebody made a comment, Germany got oil from Mexico and had U-boats all over the Gulf of Mexico to protect the tankers. That's not accurate. That is not accurate at all. There's no oil shipments. There is no oil shipments by sea into Germany after 1941. Germany was relying on the four-year plan and the synthetics, and then oil from Romania, and then iron ore and other raw materials from Scandinavia. They were dependent on the continent for raw materials and oil. They were dependent on the continent of Europe from 41 on. And I have to say, Goering's team that he had on the four-year plan they said they were joking. Okay. I've been getting a lot of emails from some of this nonsense that has been said. You know, first of all, it's hard to sneak a tanker, you know, past the British fleet. The British fleet was very formidable back then. So, you know, I heard the Germans made Zeppelins out of the skin of Jews. That'll come out next, by the way. Remember the Holocaust motto: if you think it, it must be true.
Right.
If you think it, it must be true.
Yes.
That's why the Hindenburg blew up, by the way. Jewish skin is very flammable.
Shame on you.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
That's okay. Well, I mean, Elie Wiesel, he's one of these guys that's if he thinks it, it must have been a nightmare. It must have been this. It must have been that. He makes no statement saying, yes, I saw this. He uses that same, well, I thought it, and maybe it was a nightmare.
That's
and
because
maybe
he
I'll
wasn't
wake
there.
Up someday. Right. Okay, we're going to a break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, we are back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the chairman of the All Nationalist Association and All Nationalist Network. That website is ANA-ANN.com. And the other website is WVFoundations.org.
We only have a few more minutes left, Deanna, and I want to make a couple of brief comments on some final, you know, I would consider them rather cheeky things that Charlie had said and some others have said. Charlie talked about Hitler's health and his sexuality a little bit. He alluded to those. First of all, Hitler's medical records are available. You mentioned them in the chat room. Dr. Morell's book is available. David Irving got a hold of those records and published them in the 1970s. They're very thorough. Some of the nonsensical stories are completely refuted. Also, Charlie talked about Hitler, and so has some of these other court historians, about his sexuality. The fact of the matter is, one of his housekeepers wrote a book recently in German, and she talked about having a conversation with Eva Braun. Now, it's also important, and Charlie falls into this camp, you cannot look at history through today's lenses. People did not talk, act, and most importantly, did not think the way people do today. People were much more formal. They were much more dignified. But the housekeeper talked about Chamberlain visiting the Obersalzberg and sitting on a couch in one of the sitting rooms, and she kind of remarked, oh, boy, if Mr. Chamberlain knew what me and Adolf, you know, did on that couch, he wouldn't be sitting there. Now, that seems pretty clear to me what she was referring to. The other housekeepers had talked about the relationship that they saw, you know, between Hitler Adler and Eva Braun as well. And I dare say a young woman, she was younger than him, would not have journeyed from Munich to Berlin when the city was under siege if there wasn't both a physical and emotional relationship between them. And I'll leave that there.
Right.
And, you know, we're almost out of time. Did we have any callers? If we didn't have any callers, I guess we just answered all the questions, didn't we?
Yes, we don't have any callers. And actually, I never opened the phone lines because it just seemed like, well, we had a lot of questions and comments in the chat room. The chat room has been very busy. And so...
Well, I always enjoy the chat room. And, you know, bottom line, it's like I said, it's important not to look at history through today's lenses. And as I said, a lot of these conspiracy type opinion sites that just repeat each other, they do a great disservice to real revisionist historians. And, you know, that quite frankly, that's why I stopped for a while and stopped writing stuff, because one, a lot of my work was getting poached, and then two, it just got to be ridiculous having to write responses to just nonsense, and so you just get burned out on it after a while.
Sure.
As wishful thinking, a lot of people want to engage in wishful thinking that there is an enclave in Antarctica and Hitler ran off to Patagonia and planted roses the rest of his days. It just didn't happen. The evidence isn't there. And then this lascivious junk that Charlie talked about, I'm sure people tuned in and listened to it the way his talking style is. It's great entertainment, but it's just patently false, baseless, and intellectually dishonest.
Sure. Well, I covered his history in my third book and told people where it came from, who created it, and it was pretty it was false. It was false history, and they started creating it the minute that he came into office. So.
Well, 70 years now. We've gone 70 years after the war, and the Jewish plutocratic system still will not allow an open and honest discussion of the Third Reich. And to me, that does more to discredit Charles's claims than anything else.
Sure. Well, I really appreciate you being on the program today. And for all of your facts and figures, and for just a nice visit. So thank you so much.
I want to thank you, and I want to thank RBN. Like I said, it's not many networks, RBN and mine and maybe a couple of others, that would allow this type of discussion.
Exactly. I agree with you. So thank you so much. Thank you, RBN.